Thanksgiving is right around the corner. Marcus Weaver has had a range of experiences that grounded him in God and gratitude. He's here today to talk about life lessons, helping others, and pickles.
Everybody has a situation, but it doesn't ever have to be a permanent situation.
Welcome to the Bucket List Community Cafe podcast. We're an online community journalism site for Denver. We are community inspired and supported, and we believe we build community by telling our stories. This is Noah Anderson, your podcast host and multimedia journalist for Bucket List. Welcome, Marcus.
How's it going?
Marcus, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up, and what did you do before you had a turning point in 2008?
Wow. You know, I was, my parents were both from inner city St. Louis. I was born in 1970, and, for some reason, my mom and met this guy, and they weren't really going to get married, but they ended up having me, and he didn't really want anything to do with me. And her mom wanted to have an abortion and all these things, and she decided she wanted to keep me, which I'm thankful for. And that she ended up meeting a guy by the name of Herb and ended up having two other kids, and we moved to New York City. Herb was very abusive, you know, to me, to the point where I was running away. When he found me, he would give me these serious beatings, and so it became a pattern. He worked for General Motors, so he was the breadwinner, and so he would commute back and forth, and we lived in Ossining, New York, and so it, you know, it was just crazy. Growing up, fearful of your, you know, father, and so everybody was. And so we moved to Virginia Beach, where he, you know, became a branch manager, Norfolk, you know, Virginia Beach, the Tidewater area. You know, my father was dark-skinned, and, you know, I'm a lighter-skinned black, and so I always had this feeling that he really wasn't my father, and so and my mom knew we were having problems, and so she sent me to military school. And so I went to military school, like, ages, like, what, fourth and fifth grade, and, you know, that was the thing, like, when your parents had money, they sent you these boarding schools, an all-white school, and, you know, that would become a pattern of my life, being in these environments where, you know, I am the only black person, and, you know, it was just crazy. I would have to wake up, do tiles, you know, get in a marching formation and do all this stuff. And it was just crazy. And so, of course, that didn't pan out after a while. Then I went back home and trouble started again, to the point where I started getting trouble in junior high school, you know, doing pranks, lighting smoke bombs on buses and just doing stuff at school, to the point where, you know, I had to get like a psychiatric evaluation because they were concerned about me. I was about 13 years old. And that was the time when I found out about the difference between a biological father and a real father. And on one of the sheets, it said my biological father was, you know, Anthony Hill, who my mom hadn't told me about. And so it just causes trigger to where, you know, they sent me to St. Louis for the summer to meet my real dad. And I met him for like 5 minutes, and that was it. I wouldn't see him again until I was like 35. So, you know, but it gave me a little bit of purpose to see somebody who I looked like, but it was just a really bad situation. And so I moved back. Things got better with my dad, but then it got worse again. I ended up going to like a boys' home and spent time in detention upstate and Roanoke at a boys' home called Natural Bridge Learning Center. And so that really changed my life, because I realized that the problems from speaking with a therapist and stuff there, a child therapist, that it, some of the problems that I was having in school and getting in trouble, running away, you know, petty theft, all that stuff, was to get back at my dad. And so they brought him in and they realized he was being abusive. So it kind of worked enough to get me at least through high school and out of there, but ended up being a high school father. And so my senior year, I got married and, you know, and I was going to join the military, but I got into a car accident. So I broke my foot in like 8 places and barely survived. It was crazy. And so all these things were going on in my life. And so I decided that, you know, here I had this, you know, wife that we weren't getting along, and, you know, we had a baby. And so I decided I'd move everybody to DC. And that's what kind of changed things a little bit. I was able to get employment at a Arlington Employment Center, found some housing, got a job with the Nature Conservancy, was able to travel on an internship to Montana, and just really fell in love with the mountains. And so I moved back there. Of course, the relationship wasn't working out, so I decided I was going to move. And, you know, I wouldn't see my son again until he was in his 30s, kind of reminiscent of what my life was, you know, becoming my real dad, you know. And so it was good. When I went back, because I knew what I wanted to do, I wanted to move back out here and work for the Nature Conservancy. So I moved to Boulder, well, Denver, and they had an opportunity in Boulder to work for Nature Conservancy. So I came out here, got tired of commuting, and moved to Highlands Ranch. I was able to find a good job to work for Kinko's. I worked for Dependable Cleaners for a while. Always had good jobs, but I always found it hard to maintain things. It's almost like I would find success and then find a way to ruin it. It was always this pattern where I would get in trouble, go to jail, get out, get a job again, and it kept going and going.
In 2008, you had recently graduated from radiology school, mm-hmm. At the top of your class, but then things kind of took a bad turn for you there. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Some of the stuff I was talking about before was, that being successful was something that was like my father. And so I had this weird thing where I just couldn't handle my own success and would find a way to self-sabotage. And so in 2008, after I graduated from radiology school, I had an opportunity to go all over the country and get jobs. As a matter of fact, I had won an award for class president, student of the year through the ASRT, which is the Association of Rad Technologists. I went to a conference, met all these people, and they're like, come work for me, whatever. So of course I get back, graduate, I decide I want to book bands. Book my friends' bands all over and book some other bands and do that kind of work. And then, I just didn't get pushed into radiology. I started dealing drugs. I found out how to, make crack and so start making a little bit of money doing that. But, 6 months later, I get into a high-speed car chase with police. Yeah, that's what changed things. I ran across this film and fell into a hole. And that hole became like a microcosm of what my life was. And so I asked, I was like, man, I need help, Lord. And two hands came out and pulled me out. And it's a good thing they took me to the hospital because I had renal kidney failure. And one of the guys who was doing the x-rays was a student at the school who looked up to me and told the police officer who was there, this guy's class president. He's I bounced around to five different counties from all the charges I had. I was looking at 40 years. For petty theft, what I was doing was I had a theft ring where I was getting people to go into stores and steal Apple equipment. That's what stopped it. And so while I was in there, I kept meeting guys who were just like me, who, had a good attitude about life, but just couldn't get it together. And it's because we were a lot of guys in prison and jails that I visit with were, self-sabotagers. And so I saw the judge a year later. I told him all the stuff I was going to do. It's a true story. I go, Judge, I'm going to start a nonprofit. I'm going to help people find jobs. I'm going to run, programs and all this stuff. And so he said, all right. And they decided they were just going to give me 3 years instead of 40. And so by the time I got there, I was released, paroled within, I would say, 3 or 4 months.
So what did you kind of learn during that time? You were kind of bouncing between those county jails. What life lessons did you learn that helped propel you to where you are today?
I needed some stability. I was hearing my story. I didn't have that growing up. Be more vulnerable with something that came out of that experience. Also, I taught guys how to develop elevator speeches, and I had learned that from reading books. So I got more engaged and, trying to be better to upskill, because that's what some guys needed. Everybody has a situation, but it doesn't ever have to be a permanent situation. Meaning, when someone's homeless, it's an episode of homeless. It's not, hey, they're homeless, right? And, people can get out of drug addiction too.
So after you got out, was it difficult to reacclimate to the community? Did you find it maybe difficult to find a job? How did that go?
I was so determined because I felt like I was a huge disappointment after graduating radiology school and all that. So I had this big chip on my shoulder. So what I did was when I got out, I used to help people with their reentry programs. And so I was able to, I knew all the resources. So what I did was, ended up getting out, worked for a pastor for a while, got a job at a shelter called New Genesis after staying there one night. And I was able to take that program. It's a working men's shelter right at 1680 Sherman Street right there. They're in the basement. They have about 170 beds down there. And having all the resources, I started connecting people to employers and was having job fairs down in the, down in New Genesis, because I knew guys needed work and I knew day labor wouldn't sustain them and they all had to pay $50 rent. And so it all worked out. And while I was there, I met a guy who had an idea about writing a grant.
And so we became fast friends, Dr. Malcolm Newton, and he invited me to a meeting after I did an overnight shift because he saw me reading a book on photovoltaics. I'd taken a class at Denver Works that this class for people with backgrounds to learn how to do solar panels. And so, you know, my thinking was, shoot, I could start a solar panel company and hire all these felons to do it, right? But I think the Lord had a bigger idea. So I went to that meeting and I brought in some players to help with the grant and help write up the part about the job training piece. But my part and Mikasa's part and ICAS part all became a thing called the Denver Green Job Initiative. And we won a $3 million scholarship, well, not scholarship, grant.
It sounds like after your time in jail, everything was going good for you. But then the Aurora Theater shooting happened. Mm-hmm. And it's now been 10 years since you were injured and you lost your friend Rebecca Wingo.
Uh-huh.
How are you motivated to continue to help those in need? And does that have an effect with your friendship with Rebecca?
The thing about the theater is I went in different than I came out. And the one thing that, you know, still is with me is just the energy that she has. I see it in different people. You know, I see it in my daughter. You know, I see it in all different kinds of people that have come into my life. And I'm thankful that, like, I did have that time for her. But it's hard being the last person who saw her, you know. So I there's so many things I take away from that. But the person that went in the theater is completely different than the person's come out. And the person that was there 10 years ago is different than who I am today. You know, but the work I'm doing in the community, see, I was already doing it. And, you know, I was in this transition period of my life where I was being expected to be a leader and counted on. And then the shooting thing happens. I mean, I was on the mayor's workforce board. I was doing all kinds of stuff. I was getting out into trouble. You know, this new period where I had free freedom. And the shooting happens. And what it did was it opened up a lot of different doors that I don't think would have been open if that hadn't happened to me. But you just want to be that same Marcus before, who was just, you know, working at Bud's Warehouse and, you know, helping people. And just you just can't. And it's like you let strangers into your house almost. And they stayed there for about 3 good years. Get lots of TV, lots of interviews. You know, I wrote a book about, you know, the experience I had like right after the shooting where, you know, the press kept asking me 2 questions. Do you believe in the death penalty? And I always said, well, it's really not up to me, you know, and then everybody's opinion varied too. So, you know, it's not up to me, it's up to the jury. But the other part was, you know, would you forgive the shooter? And that was the thing that really got me, because here I was, and you've heard my journey when I was a youngster. I hated my father. Like, he was the worst thing ever. And I would get in trouble just to get back at him, you know. And then when you become an adult, it don't matter anymore, but you're still, you've got this hate, this energy that's super negative. And so I didn't want to have that anymore or carry the rocks on my back of hating this guy who I could never see, touch, or talk to, just see in a courtroom. And so, you know, I said, well, I'll go ahead and forgive the shooter, because I just didn't want that anymore, you know. And it helped me, you know, move on from it quicker than others. It's able to talk about my experience, which kind of helped. But, you know, I don't talk about Rebecca too much, because, you know, Rebecca has her place, you know, in my life. And, you know, if sometimes when you talk about it too much, you know, you can go back into nightmares because you're re-traumatizing yourself. So I rarely talk about it as much, but, you know, around theater time, I'll talk about it a little bit. But like I said, it has its place, and I just put it in a box.
You now have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
How old is she?
She's 7.
Okay. And what role has Maggie played in your life now?
Well, when Maggie came around, she was just this, I had met her mom, who I had knew before the shooting, and we met at church, and we just became friends. And next thing you know, we're getting married, and she gets pregnant, and, you know, and then the theater's backdrop's going on. And, you know, I remember Maggie was born on the highway right there at I-70 and 225. So not I-70 and 225. What is it? It's Yosemite and 225. And I delivered her. So me and her mom will always be special and friends, even though the relationship worked out. But Maggie was born in a period of my life where things were changing. And then, you know, the theater moved away, and then I was a parent, you know, and I was working, and, you know, it became hard as, you know, we added things to the relationship that, you know, you couldn't normally, people wouldn't withstand, but we made it through, at least for Maggie. And, you know, she's just a symbol of this new hope that, like, you know, things are going to get better.
Are you always looking to be a role model or someone that she can look up to now?
I don't know. I think it just comes natural that kids look up to their father. And so it's up to you to ruin that, you know. And so I'm just glad that she's in my life. And, you know, I just think that she has learned a lot about life from me, and I learned a lot about from her.
Let's talk about your pickle business now. Mm-hmm. Have you always had an entrepreneurial drive? And how did that kind of propel you to start the People's Pickles?
So I was just like, man, I wish I could start a job training program, because I had been on them at Bud's Warehouse was the job training program, you know, and I knew training, because of the work I did earlier, would help folks get to the level. And I knew there wasn't a lot of resources when guys get out. So that's how the pickles became a business. I would go home every summer and eat them, and, you know, and I just loved them. And I was like, man, I wonder if I could learn how to make these. And so my cousin in August of 2019 sold me the recipe for like, I think just $1,000. And he said, I go, you sure you don't want me to sell you a dollar a jar? And he's like, no, you go ahead and make your millions. And so to this day, he regrets it. But I, you know, I always pay credit to him for teaching me. And so I learned how to make them. And we started down at Brother Jeff's, just, you know, handing them out, selling them, and people just really gravitated towards. We're like, politicians and, you know, community activists were coming by and sampling them and taking pictures, to where a news station got a hold of the story. And of course, when they tell my story, they tell the whole story about the shooting and all this stuff I'm doing. And so it just became this thing, the People's Pickles. And I created this buzz about it in this audience. And at that point, I said, well, shoot, I think I need to make it a nonprofit. And that way I can franchise it or grow it to where, you know, I could work with more people and I can get funding for the job training part. And the business will take care of, you know, the recipes. And, you know, and then I would train guys on going out and selling themselves, teach them how to do elevator speeches, forklift, all that stuff within 30 days, and then move them to permanent jobs. And so I wrote a grant. I won a pitch contest from Deloitte and United Way. And it was cool because I was up against some big companies, and here I'm doing this little pitch about, you know, how I want to help people get jobs to a pickle company, right? And we won. And so I was able to hire a guy named Raymond Johnson. And I still to this day, I'm so thankful I got him. And he came to me through a roundabout way through a woman named Charlotta Evans, who, how they know each other is Raymond shot her son in a gang shooting. And what happened there was he got hit by a bullet. And so for years, Raymond wanted to talk to her, but she didn't want to talk to him. Then she finally accepted the letter. They went through a restorative justice thing, and he had life, right? But then they changed some rulings where he was able to get out. And so she didn't tell me all this part, because I only know her from working with survivors and telling our stories. So we both told our stories to the state of Colorado about our experience around the death penalty that we, you know, wanted repealed, and we got it repealed. And so that's how we knew each other. And then she kept telling me, I got a son coming out. I need you to help him when he gets out. And everybody says that to me. Well, I didn't know she was going to see me, Raymond, and Raymond told me a story and put it all together. And I just felt so compelled to help him. And so we put him through the program, and now he's the program manager, you know, and he's doing really good. He's got his own apartment now, his own car, and, you know, we're about to grow the pickles. We did a story for 7 News about the pickle program, just a story to just, you know, tell people about what we do. And a vice president from Safeway saw it, and they're like, we want to green light your pickles. So they were bugging me about doing it, and I wanted to stay small. But then I realized, you know what, let's do something big, but let's find a bigger kitchen space, all those things. And we're going to be moving into a kitchen at 35th and Brighton that's like a co-op through Focus Points. And so they're going to help us market. We're going to be able to do production, you know, to ramp up for Safeway. We're you know, raising money for the FDA labels so we can get more than Safeway. And it's just going to grow to be something. And so the cool thing is we can take that and the outreach center and all the things we do there, you know, and really make impacts in communities of color, communities where, you know, they need job training programs, where they don't have them when guys get out, because it's designed just to wrap yourself around these folks, because they'll be out in your community, you know. And it's just a beautiful thing to see people grow, you know, when you just, you know, a mustard seed, you know, and then you just, and that's what it's all about.
So going back to your family recipe for the pickles, what about the way that you make your pickles makes them so special or different than other brands?
Well, it's a family recipe that dates back a long time, but, you know, I think what makes them different, so somebody makes them with their own hands, you know what I mean? They're like handcrafted. They're really thick, you know, and they're really juicy. You know, we get these special cucumbers that when you brine them up really good, they're nice and thick. And so that's kind of our thing. You know, it's for the people, by the people. It's made by people. Other people buy them to help other people. So, you know, we're just excited about, you know, where we're at with that, just because it was, like I said, it was just an idea. But you never know. Just like that mustard, you're just an idea that will grow that could be something nationwide, especially, you know, working with a partner like Safeway. And, you know, it's a young company. So I just, at first I was real cautious, but now it's like, you know, let's do it.
So you mentioned the People's Pickles program. What kind of experience does that offer for people who sell them?
You know, when you, even if you're shy, even if you're, you know, new to the world or new to selling things, I think we make it to where it's personable, like, because I teach them how to make them and I teach them how to run the business, so they feel what invested, right? You got to remember, when guys get out, they need supports, and you know, you can't just get out and a guy get a job and expect him to find housing and all those other things. And so what we do is we try to meet people where they're at, because I know what that's like, right? There weren't a lot of people saying, oh, hey, here's a job, oh, here's housing, you know. A lot of times you have to wait until things happen. For this program is just really designed to get them going, and part of getting going is being able to own what you did and tell your story. So everybody knows the community, the People's Pickles works with ex-offenders, right? So the cool part is put them down to a place like Brother Jeff, who is a natural mentor and somebody who really appreciates my program, talking to those guys. Community people coming in to Brother Jeff's on Black Dollar Saturday, you know, you're able to use what we try to teach them, the elevator speech, where they're able to, you know, share their experience and their story and own it. And I think what it does is it allows them not to recidivate. It allows them to latch with people in the community. You know, we go out to the flea market, same thing. They telling their story because people want to hear. It's like, oh, you're a job training program. That's right, ma'am. I got out, like, you know, I served Raymond. I served 26 years, you know, and I came through this program doing really well and got my own car and my own thing. And so, you know, you can also donate to us. Here you go. And people love that. And so we want to keep it going, because the more we do and the more places we can be, the better. So
you've always focused your attention on helping marginalized communities. Why is that so important to you?
Oh, man. I think it's important to me because it's the way I grew up in Virginia Beach, because we grew up middle class. I'm not going to lie. We were kind of like the Cosby family, but not rich like Cosby family portrayed themselves to be, like a brownstone in New York. But for Virginia Beach, your dad worked for General Motors. Your mom owned a linen company. You know, we made pretty good money and we went to good schools and all those things. And so that summer I went to St. Louis to meet my father really changed my life. You know, it was Purple Rain was out, you know, and yeah, you know, they lived in the projects, but I thought they were townhouses. And so I was calling my mom and say, you know what, mom, how come they got concrete everywhere, you know, and how come they don't have, you know, credit cards, and what's layaway? You know, I learned what a pawn shop was, you know, all these things. And so I realized at that time that Black people were different. You know what I mean? You know, my dad, even though he was a jerk, he got us in the roots. You know, we learned different things. You know, he always made us aware of our Blackness. It was almost, he made us aware of our Blackness so much it became like anti-Blackness, it seemed, right? Well, shoot, if they don't like me, then why we even bother, right? But I knew better because I had people around me, you know, that really like sewed into my life. And, you know, I work for the Nature Conservancy, you know, that what they do is protect the environment. So I think the places I work to shaped my belief that, like, there are people generally who need people. You know, and for a while you start taking jobs where you're the boss and stuff, but that wasn't really me. And so, you know what I mean? So I think helping people has always been something I was always about. and, you know, to get paid for it, especially after, you know, being incarcerated, it means even more to help people who were in the same boat as I was. Do you know what I mean? It means a lot to sit on the mayor's workforce board, to be in that space, to be able to talk about, hey, well, what about my reentry people? What about African Americans? You know, we have a larger unemployment rate than whites do. And why is that? And so I like looking at those reasons, and I try to come up with systems to help the least, because the ones that can will do it, but the ones that can't, they won't, because they need help.
You have a lot to be grateful for. What are some of your experiences, and what have they taught you about being thankful?
I think when Maggie was born and on the highway, I was thankful because in hindsight, a lot of things could have went wrong that didn't go wrong. And so I'm really thankful for being able to get off the floor of that theater, you know, and have the wherewithal to slow things down enough to, in my head, to hear a voice say, hey, he's going to stop shooting. You get up and leave the theater. And so, you know, the car accident I was in, all these just different things. You know, the outreach center this year just broke ground on a 36-unit supportive housing building, and I'm going to be the manager of it. Like, I just think my faith, and it's been, you know, when I first got baptized, I didn't go to church. I got in trouble. But that time I spent, you know, behind the wall for the little time I did, the year I did was like a big Bible study for me. And so I got to know who I was through the word, and I just carried it out with me. And a lot of things I do is based on, you know, knowing, have a true sense of right and wrong and knowing who I am. And so I just, you know, faith has a lot to do with it. I don't have a father who was teaching me things. The real father I had, I felt, was Jesus. And so I just followed some of those teachings, and I still do today. You know, at the Outreach Center, we have a Bible study and stuff like that at the end of the morning, because I like to feel connected. And, you know, I have good examples like Pastor Bob and Miss Eddie that, you know, show me if you keep doing good, you keep storing up these good things, you're going to reap a harvest. And my life has become a harvest. You know, I'm in places that I shouldn't been. I only have a associate's degree, but people will pay to hear me talk about how to build a job training program for offenders, or how to start, get grants and things like that. And I think it's the Lord who gave me the ability to do it. I just had to walk into it.
So what have those people experiencing homelessness and the underserved taught you about gratitude?
Well, you know, at the Outreach Center, we do triages on everybody who walks through the door. We ask if you got an ID, birth certificate, social security card, you know, SNAP benefits, Medicaid, all that kind of thing, because these are the things that to help people. Like, it's one thing to put somebody in housing for 3 days, and then you expect them to, you know, call people and get more help. It's not going to work out like that. And so I'm thankful that I have a job that I get to help people, but they don't realize how much they bless me too. Because as you know, I was almost not here a few times. And so I'm grateful to help them. And I think I see the gratitude in the way they keep coming back, and the way that, you know, I send them out to get an ID and say, you come back, I'll get you a job. Then I get them a job. Then we get them housing, and just seeing people grow and just, you know, using my talents to help other people. And I don't think that they could ever repay me back. And so I think there's a beauty in that.
Thank you, Marcus Weaver, for coming on the podcast. You can check out the People's Pickles at thepeoplespickles.com. Maybe have some at your Thanksgiving table. And thanks for listening to the Bucket List Community Cafe podcast. From November 29th through December 31st, we'll be having our News Colorado Needs fundraising campaign. Bucket List Community Cafe is one of 33 community newsrooms that has received a $5,000 matching grant from the Colorado Media Project. Every penny contributed up to $5,000 will be matched. We build community by telling our stories and are supported by you. Happy Thanksgiving, Bucket Listers.